primarily Matthew chapter 11, the story that we just read about John the Baptist. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, some of you might know that name, he once wrote, "Celebrating Advent means being able to wait." Means being able to wait. And then he observed this. He said, "Waiting, however, is an art that our impatient age has forgotten." Waiting is an art that our impatient age has forgotten. What Bonhoeffer puts his finger on is, a forgotten piece of wisdom. And it's woven into the very fabric of creation. In other words, once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's everywhere all at once. It's this. It's that there's a gift in waiting. Because as you wait, you might just realize that life isn't fundamentally about grabbing or taking or cajoling or grasping. But rather, life is fundamentally, it's something that you receive. And more precisely, it's something that's meant to be received as a gift. And so in waiting, there's a chance. There's a chance that we might wake up and become more alert to this reality that's all around us all the time. Which is, it points to the very nature and the character of our God. Let me show you what I mean, just in everyday life. Maybe some of you plant vegetable gardens? No one? A few? You wait long, wintry, rainy months, and eventually you get to spring, and then you gotta wait a little longer. And then eventually, at the right time, you plant those seeds, right? Then you wait some more. And eventually, after a lot of waiting, you can grab that cucumber or whatever it is in the middle of summer, cut it up, throw it in your salad, and enjoy the gift of this cucumber. You couldn't make it happen, could you? You participated, but fundamentally, it's something that you receive. This is true with friendship. The very best of friends, the very best friends aren't ones that you just meet one day and then you're best friends that day. It takes time. You have to wait. You listen to one another. You laugh. You cry. You share life with one another. And slowly, two souls kind of like unfurl, right? They intertwine. And you realize that you can't force friendship. You can't make it happen. It's given to you as a gift that you receive. My sister just waited 9 long months. She couldn't make it happen any faster. She had to wait. And the gift of this baby boy. It's everywhere. There's this clear reminder in our age of hurry, accumulation, anxiety, speed, we miss what's most fundamental and basic in life. Even the breath in our lungs. It has to be received as a gift. Now, I don't know about you, but life doesn't often feel this way for me, if I'm honest. If I'm honest, most of my life feels a little more angsty, a little more like a kind of unsettled wrestling match. And sometimes I feel like I just live on this kind of mental treadmill. And a lot of life feels like I'm waiting just to move beyond or move past whatever the circumstances that's in front of me. But then there's also these even more difficult seasons in our lives that we're faced with situations that can be actually quite disorienting. And I could list any number of things, but a loss of a job, feeling stuck, the sense of failure, loss of a family member, any host of possibilities that pretty quickly place us in this place where fear or angst or uncertainty kind of take a grip and hold our lives. And some of you may be even going through this right now. And so life feels far sometimes. It feels far from something that you receive as a gift. And questions like, how long? How long, O Lord? Did I do something wrong? Did I just get the short end of the stick? Or maybe if you're trying to think really hard about it, what is all this suffering in the world or in my life? What does it say about God and the way he relates to me? Is there any purpose in this, or is it just futile? Well, if you have your Bibles, you can open up to Matthew chapter 11. And I want to think about some of these questions alongside John the Baptist, his story. This great prophet and this forerunner to Jesus, he's grappling with some of these realities in his circumstances. I don't want to be confusing, but just for a moment, hold that open, and I want you to think back to the very beginning, not when we're introduced to John for the first time, but when we see him out kind of waist deep in the Jordan River, He's out there, and what's he doing? He's announcing, it's time. No more waiting. Get ready. He's here, right? There's this sense of certainty, right? He sees Jesus walking down the hill. He goes, there's the one. That's the one we've been waiting for, the Lamb of God who's come to take away the sin of the world. Here's the one who's going to baptize with the Holy Spirit and fire, and he's going to bring the hammer, and he's going to set the world to rights. He's going to bring justice is what he's going to do, right? So here's this man at the beginning of the Gospels, in the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John the Baptist, out there baptizing, living with full of conviction and clarity. But here in Matthew chapter 11, contrast that with this, where he's at today, and he's been arrested by Herod, and he's sitting there, and he's rotting in a prison. Hears through the grapevine what Jesus is up to out in the world outside those four walls, and from the stillness of his prison cell, he sends this question by way of his disciples. Are you the one? Are you? Are you the one who's to come, or should we be looking for another one? You feel that? The weight of human uncertainty in his voice? That's not how this is supposed to be going. I want to sit with this a little bit this morning. I want to let this linger. Let this question linger. Are these circumstances going to change, or do I need to get to plan B here? Make something happen. Because my hope was in you, but I'm not so certain I put that in the right spot at this moment. You know this. You know it personally. I don't have to convince you. These are questions that we ask all the time. We're waiting, anxiously running in circles mentally, right? And for some of us here in the room, it's maybe something that you feel like, I know this is kind of simple, but I got to pass this exam, and there's a lot of anxiety about this, because that obviously has everything to do with my future. And if I don't do this, then am I ever going to be able to buy a house? Am I ever going to be able to retire? I mean, am I ever going to meet someone? There's the simple questions like this, right? But we feel them. It's not just John's question in prison. It's our question, too. It's part of being a human. And sometimes it's like our circumstances and what's going around in our lives, but sometimes it's what's going on out in the world, too. Maybe you feel that. They call that doom scrolling, I think is what they're calling that nowadays. You look out, and there's another violent conflict in the Middle East. There's more increasing levels of poverty and addiction when you drive around Vancouver. Increasing polarization south of the border and seemingly everywhere. How long? How long, O Lord? Are you the one? That question resonates deeply. Maybe for some of us, it's not just the recognition of brokenness out there or the circumstances that we're going through. It's actually something that's going on inside your own heart. It's like, how long am I going to continue to be stuck in this cycle of addiction? How long am I going to keep soothing myself in this way that is destructive for me and my family? How long am I going to be stuck in this? Are you the one, Jesus? Are you? This is the existential experience of being human, living in a fallen world. This is the question that John asks. So remember with me, he's rotting in prison. He hears what Jesus is doing. He doesn't see how all this fits into the plan of how he saw this, how he expected this all to go. And like many in ancient Israel, John expects that the Messiah, the one who's going to come and rescue, the one that he's announced and kind of said, make the path straight, clear the way, here he comes. He's expecting that this Messiah is going to come and bring the hammer. He's going to bring justice. He's going to set things to rights, right? But instead, he's just sitting there in that cold, dark prison cell. And so he asks this question, and then look at Jesus' response in verses 4 and 5. Go and tell John this. Go and tell John this, he says to John's disciples. What you hear and what you see. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor of the earth learn that God's on their side. As always, Jesus' answers are always clear, right? I don't know why. But how is that an answer? How is it an answer? He's given a summary of what he's just been up to. If you were to read just before that in Matthew, you'd see him do literally everything that you just read there. But more than that, Jesus is actually picking up these lines, some from the book of Isaiah that we just read. He's quoting from actually four different passages in Isaiah. 35, 42, 61, 29, kind of puts them in a blender, throws them here and says, this is what's happening. And they're all passages that talk about the great day that John had been prophesying about. The great day when the God of Israel would visit his people with salvation and judgment, purify his people, send the messianic kingdom, and set the world to rights. And so what's Jesus saying to John here? He's saying, listen, John, the kingdom, it's here. It's here. You're not wrong. It just doesn't look quite like what you thought it was, John. It's not quite what you were expecting. And then there are those, harrowing words for me. Real vulnerably, these are harrowing words for me. Look at verse 6. Blessed is the one who's not offended by me. The one who's not scandalized by this reality. Right? John tells everyone that the hammer's coming. He's going to set the world to rights. But Jesus comes and he's having these feasts and he's inviting sinners and tax collectors and he says, bring your friends. And he's spending time with them. He's like, come experience me. Come get to know me. And John's like, that's awesome. People are getting healed. You're doing that. But what about me? I'm in prison here. What about the hammer? I want to pause there, and I just want you to notice Jesus' reaction. You notice that Jesus doesn't rebuke John in this passage? He says, listen, John, it's here. It just looks different than what you expected and what you thought it would look like. And so notice here, I just want to point this out. Jesus doesn't dismiss this. Jesus, I think he recognized that there's something going on in John's head, right? Where there's a disconnect. It reveals kind of like a cognitive dissonance. Wherever John's question is coming from, which is all of our questions, it comes from a place where John clearly had a story in his head, right, about how this was supposed to go for him. How things were going to go. And I think this is true of all of us. It's true of me. And usually we don't find out what those expectations are, that story that we tell ourselves about how this thing is supposed to go, until disappointment or suffering or crisis or something happens that kind of reveals this. We're like, we feel a lot of big emotions and we go, wait a second, there's something going on here. I had a whole set of expectations. And so, in other words, unexpected suffering in our lives has a way of revealing our hidden expectations. And like I said, we don't often realize this a lot, but I think we do this. We do this a lot, even in the way we follow Jesus. And I know this is a hard thing, a message, and I feel this deeply in my own life, just so you know. But I think sometimes we can default into this mode where we follow Jesus because we think he's going to solve all of our problems and deliver us out of all of our circumstances. I do. And we don't actually realize that until maybe our dreams don't come true or our nightmares show up in ways that we didn't want. And then we find ourselves in this space where we feel deeply, verse 6, I'm scandalized by Jesus. I'm offended by him. I stumble. That language of stumble, I stumble on him. I think this raises a pretty difficult question, an honest question. If there isn't like a full guarantee that he's going to rescue me out of these present circumstances that I might be going through, if that's true for John in this situation, and it's true for Jesus as he follows the path of what God has for his life, and it's true for many of the disciples, then why do I follow Jesus? Right? I want to let that question again hang with us for a moment. And then I want to go back and I want to look what Jesus says about John. John's disciples, they leave, and Jesus speaks to the crowd about John, and he has nothing negative to say about him. John's doubting Jesus, but Jesus isn't doubting John. In verse 7, he turns to the crowd and he says, hey, everybody, what did you go out into the desert, the wilderness, to see? When you went out to see John, were you going out there to see a reed that was swayed by the wind? Did you go see a pushover? someone who's kind of weak and passive and whimsical or flimsy. Someone who just kind of caves under pressure and lives for the expectations of the crowd. No, you didn't do that. Well, then what'd you go out to the desert to see? Did you go to find a man in soft clothing? Verse 8. Someone with a silver spoon in his mouth? Fancy, living in palaces? No, you didn't go out to see that either. That's not who John is. You went out to see a prophet. That's who you went out to see. Oh yeah, he's more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, and he quotes from Malachi 3 here. I send my messenger ahead of you who is going to prepare the way. This is really important. I'm not going to have a lot of time to get into it. But Jesus is affirming John's role. And then there's a later verse, which we're not going to have time to look at. But Jesus, he gets to this point. He's like, John is in the role of Elijah. He's the one that all the prophets have been prophesying about. And the role of Elijah, everyone listening to Jesus knows this. They would have known this. That when the reappearance of Elijah, who Jesus says is John, when that takes place, this means that there is no one left in the line of prophets to appear. Except now it's God. This is the day. So Jesus is affirming John here. He's not just a prophet, he's the prophet. He's the one that all of them look forward to. Jesus says John's that guy, all right? And look at verses 11 and 12. Truly, I tell you, among those born of women, Jesus says, there has arisen no one greater than John the Baptist, yet whoever is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. Now, this is kind of an odd saying. Jesus lived 2,000 years ago. But he's saying that John the Baptist is actually one of the most unique and privileged human beings that have ever been, because he plays this unique kind of pivot role. He plays this sort of hinge role in history. He's the prophet who announced the great day. But Jesus says here in this saying, what he's saying is that John's going to die in prison. He's not actually going to get to see this. But you, anybody who is still alive or in the future, you get to see it with your own eyes. And then later on in this passage, I know we don't have all the time to go there, but he says, you have ears to hear this? He doesn't say it like this, but do you got eyes to see this? John doesn't get to see it, but you get to see it. But do you have eyes to see it? Because you might miss it, is what Jesus is saying. Because if you continue to inhabit that story that we tell ourselves, if you keep kind of defaulting that place of that we live as human beings, if you maintain that posture of kind of unexamined expectations that you carry that are underneath kind of our everyday lives, if you keep doing that, you're going to miss what I'm doing. You're going to miss what's happening under the surface of our lives. You're going to keep defaulting towards that other posture. You'll miss it. Look at verse 12. This is where I want to kind of spend the rest of our time. There's this really clear contrast between waiting and force, taking, seizing, grasping, making it happen. These two postures. Look at verse 12. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent try to take it by force. He's saying, here's where the rub is. This is where it's different. Ever since John comes on the scene, he starts announcing the kingdom of heaven. Jesus shows up, he starts living the kingdom of heaven, teaching about the kingdom of heaven, and it's in a way that nobody expected. And there starts to be this growing, violent opposition, whether it's from the Bible teachers, the Pharisees, whether it's from the Sadducees, who are kind of in charge of the temple, whether it's from the political government, like from Rome and King Herod, who's arrested John and thrown him in prison. Whether it's from them, Herod, who's eventually going to put Jesus on the cross. So just stop with me for a moment and think about these two postures. Consider how these two different ways of being. On one side, you have John, and more specifically, you have Jesus. But John's going to have his head cut off in a couple chapters, right? And Jesus is going to face growing opposition until he gets arrested. And then he's going to be put up on false charges. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. And then he's going to get hung on a Roman execution rack, where he suffers and dies. John dies and Jesus dies, and they both die by force. By those who take, who seize, who grab, who cajole, who force, And they do this from a place of fear and angst and self-protection, and all of it's always justified, right? If you're like me or John the Baptist or many people in Jesus' days, or you're just a human being, and then according to the story that we play in our heads, all of this looks like failure, right? They're not delivered from any of these circumstances. They're not delivered of death. This whole thing is not solving anything, what's just happened to John and what's happened to Jesus. But here's what I want to leave you with this morning. Jesus is not, he is not playing the same story in his head as the rest of us are. He doesn't see the world as we often see the world. He sees what's going on underneath. He sees what God's up to. He doesn't live from a place of first and foremost where he relates to the world. And you notice that? He's not always trying to force things, make it happen the way we think it should be or the way that we want it to be, right? This posture is the same one, if you remember back to the garden story. They reach out and they seize that fruit and they take it and they eat it. It's mine, right? No, Jesus is actually alone in human history. He's the only one who exemplifies a radically different posture. He walks in a profoundly different way. And it's because of this. He knows the Father's love and commitment to himself and to all of creation. He knows it deeply. He treasures it in his heart. Jesus knows that God, his Father, is the creator and the sustainer of life. And he will not allow sin and death to get the final word. And thus, Jesus trusts this so much. He trusts his Father so much that even in the face of great pain, suffering, and death, every detail of his life yields to this reality. I want to be really clear. Jesus is not some weak and passive victim up there that gets crushed in the cycles of history. He isn't someone who's weak and passive and sort of, Jesus isn't someone who lacks assertiveness. But you should see in him a profound strength. Jesus lives with crystal clear clarity, conviction, and character. He has a deep understanding and a total trust and a total faith in the Father's character, in the Father's will. And you see that. It's not like Jesus doesn't grapple with these existential questions. You see it in the Garden of Gethsemane. Remember that? He's in the darkness of that garden, that long, long night. And he gets to that point where he says, not my will, but your will be done. He lives that out in his life. You see, can you just give me a little nod? You see these two postures? You see what Jesus does? He unleashes an entire different way of being human. He shows the very heart and the character of God, and he opens up this space for us to receive a whole different kind of life. My prayer for you this Christmas is that you wouldn't try and do a better job waiting. I gotta wait, I gotta be more patient. My prayer is that as you lay eyes on Jesus this morning, you hear what he says, you watch what he does, you'd see in his life a perfect trust. It's a way of waiting that is wholly surrendered to his Father. And in his great act of faithfulness, he opens up a way for grace, forgiveness, healing, beauty, joy to move into our world, into your life. We're going to leave you with this little, we're going to sing this little hymn, O Little Town of Bethlehem. At least I think we're going to sing this. It says, the hopes and the fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. So celebrating Advent, like Bonhoeffer said, is about being able to wait. I might add, in the midst of our hopes and fears. And so this Advent, in whatever, I don't know whatever situation life finds you right now, where you're waiting, but may Christ's faithfulness, his patient faithfulness, awake and alert you to the gift of his peace, of his hope, of his joy, and his love. Amen.
Stand as we sing, O Little Town of